personally set up every time we went someplace, along with a subedar, my local chief.
Okay.
And we would set up, we would use natural terrain features for cover and concealment. And we would make sure we had the best possible fields of fire covering all approaches,
yeah.
Right? And then we would have it so arranged that we could fall back. It was a mobile defensive setup. We could fall back into positions of increasing strength. So if you had three men here and three men over there, and when they fell back and there'd be another three-man group back here, these both would fall back and you got a nine-man group there.
Yeah, so I understand.
Got a heavier concentration of firepower,
uh-huh.
Same fields of fire practically. And then if they had to fall back even further...
Nine to 27.
Yeah, you'd be still stronger. You'd have a whole platoon.
Okay, but the idea was to get outside of the village,
right,
out into the...
And change it every night.
Watching the roads from the path, right, from village to hamlet to hamlet.
Right.
Okay.
Well, what you'd have, you know, like you have a canal like here.
Yeah.
Okay? And then you get houses here all along, okay? And it might be strung out about a mile. Then over here, you get paddy fields.
Yeah.
Okay? Rice. And here and here, you get trees.
Yep.
And you got various other terrain features, bushes, yep, and coconut trees with a big, heavy, thick, matted roots and so forth.
Okay.
Okay? And so you'd put, say, what you do, instead of trying to have a triangular fort like this,
mm-hmm,
one place like that to try to cover this, somebody could come in this way,
yep,
they could come in by the canal on sampans, they could,
yep,
come in anyway. You would set your defenses up and you'd just take one segment, like a... maybe 500 meters or so,
mm-hmm,
at the most, if that much, maybe 200,
mm-hmm,
depending on the configuration of that particular hamlet, every one of them different. And then you'd set up maybe a three-man team here, okay? They'd be, and what they would do, now, I had this all worked out by Australians, because I didn't have the time to sit down and work it out, and I talked to an Australian colonel, Colonel Barnard,
mm-hmm,
Bernard, about the concept of defending revolutionary development teams in the hamlets, and I wanted everybody in the hamlet to be defended. And when I discussed it with this guy, he says, I can see the problem. He says, it's a hell of a job to train it, but he says, I tell you what I can do, I can loan you two warren officers.
Mm-hmm.
And so he gave me two warren officers who were highly seasoned combat veterans. And both these guys were great. And I described to them precisely what I wanted to work out. And then they went out and they lived in some of the hamlets.
Yep.
And then they experimented.
Yep.
And with the RD teams. And the way they figured, they found that there were enough vines everywhere so that if they didn't have string, they could use vines.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys, the three men would be here. Say there'd be one man here and two back here.
Mm-hmm.
This guy would be alerted at all times, maybe all three of them, depending on the situation. Then there'd be three over here, like one here, two here, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Right here, you'd have three men too, okay? So, they've got this guy is connected with a string to these other guys, all right?
Yeah.
And if one tug on the string means alert, something's out there, you know?
Yeah.
Two tugs might mean something else, three tugs would mean we pull back, say.
Yeah.
But anyway, they could be silent. They could be close enough to one another to sort of give mutual support.
Yeah.
And make sure...
And I assume this is night.
This at night.
Yeah, it is all night.
So
okay.
Yeah.
No need for this during, yeah, the day.
And every night you go to a different place.
Yeah.
You take a different segment of the village, and you,
yeah,
just use natural terrain features.
Yeah.
You don't dig entrenchments and so forth,
yeah,
where the enemy can get intelligence on,
yeah,
where your positions were.
Who are the Vietnamese that are doing this?
These are the RD team,
these are the
along
RD?
With the People's Self-Defense Force.
Okay. Because the RD team is sort of the cadre,
right,
which enlists,
yeah,
the people from the village, and they'll say, like, well, the six of us are going to do this, or the 12 of us, or the 30 of us are going to do this, and you people, you're going to give us some volunteers, and these guys from the village are going to come,
right,
with us. And so you got maybe one RD guy and two villagers,
right,
and one RD guy and two villagers.
Usually would be the security chief of the RD team would,
okay,
be the guy who would organize this.
Okay.
Okay? And so then, and they would have the same over here along the canal. They'd have maybe a three-man team here and a three-man team here. Or they could have one man or two men, you know, depending on the situation.
Right, I assume.
And then they'd have somebody else here. Now, in the center here, they may have the rest of the guys scattered and sleeping,
yeah,
in position, so they can all reinforce here or here or here.
Yeah.
Okay? Now, whenever they would just take one segment one,
yeah,
night, they'd change it, another night they'd be somewhere else, and they wouldn't say until it was just about to get to dark. They'd assemble everybody and they'd say, okay, well, this is where we're going to go, you know?
Yeah.
And they'd put them all in position just before dark. Now, that would there'd be no chance of the enemy getting intelligence on him. And we had been watching the pattern of the enemy for a long, long time. They never attacked a hamlet without thorough intelligence.
Yeah.
Without even sometimes setting a mock-up. What the hell do you call it? A place that looked like it.
Yeah, sure.
That they could practice and rehearse ahead of time.
The VC did that.
The VC did this. They would know exactly where you had your Claymore mines.
Huh.
You know?
Really?
And they would know, and without that, they never attacked. Never attacked. Now, we had experience later on in the Delta. Once we got this whole system working, and that we had, I'd say close to 100 villages using this system.
Mm-hmm. In spread around the provinces.
Spread around in the different provinces of the Delta. Not a single one of those provinces was ever attacked in all the time that I was there now. And this is, we didn't get this thing organized till near the very end, of my tour. Not a single one of those that was using this was attacked. But a number of the others, particularly the PF units, where they had PF units in a triangular fort on the edge of a hamlet, those outfits would continue to be attacked. You know, maybe 60 attacks a month. Not a single one against the RD teams that were using this concept, but there were attacks against RD teams who had not yet been retrained for it.
Okay.
Because you realize we had a lot of RD teams up there that had to be retrained for this. Uh-huh. Now, to get them to buy this, we had to get Colonel Bay down.
Yeah, I know. Okay.
Major Bay.
He lived with Scott.
Yeah.
Until he died.
Did he die? Colonel Bay?
Yeah, of cancer.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, 5 years ago.
No kidding. I've been down here now 6 years,
yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. Anyway, Colonel Bay, when they brought him down to witness this, now we had this down on the parade ground.
Mm-hmm.
We ran them through by the numbers for the training. So it was almost like close order drill.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I explained the setup to Colonel Bay first, and then the Australians took over, and they explained exactly what they were going to do, and then they ran through, and they showed exactly how to train them. Now, these guys have been doing this for about 3 months before we set this thing up, and they were really good at it. They ran it through by the numbers, and it just worked perfectly, and Colonel Bay says, I fully support this concept, and we will institute it starting tomorrow.
Okay.
We're going to start training in Bung Tao. And then we put as many people through. We would take security chiefs from different RD teams and send them up to Vung Tao to go through this again.
Okay. You know?
Although we had used the Australians for a while to train a lot of them in the Delta.
How many Aussies did you have all together?
Just two.
Just two?
Two guys, yeah. Two real tough guys. I can't even remember the names now. I wish I'd put them down. But...
Yeah, well...
Unfortunately, like almost everything in Vietnam, we started this too late. You know, if we had started this at the beginning of the RD program in 1964, had this kind of a defense instead of the static perimeter defenses that they built everywhere, the RD program would have worked a hell of a lot.
Well, you see, now Scott told me that that was his idea back in 64, 65.
What idea?
Was not having static defenses.
Yeah, I know everybody was complaining about static defenses, but
nobody
didn't come up with solutions.
Okay.
So, this is what I could explain it to, you know, because...
Well, who are the people that you were trying to convince, the Vietnamese or Americans?
Oh, I had to convince everybody.
Well, who in the American side did you have to convince that this was a good idea? The people who were running Vung Tao?
Well, the guy who was running Vung Tao bought it immediately.
Was that Eschbach?
Bob Eschbach, yeah. Okay. Now, I knew Bob Eschbach back in 1943 when he was a sergeant at the parachute school at Fort Benning, Georgia. And then he then went, when I saw him, when I went through the parachute school, he was still a sergeant, but just a few weeks later, he went to officer school.
Mm-hmm.
Became an officer. Anyway, I saw Bob Eschbach when I first went into the country, and then Bob went with me. I called him down first, showed him this demonstration.
Okay.
And then had him prepare Colonel Bay.
Okay.
And he took Beta.
What was Eschbach's reaction?
He bought it.
Bought it right away?
Bought it right away, yeah.
Okay.
Because I explained to him first. And he knew a lot about my background and experience I'd had in this kind of thing.
What can you tell me about him? He's dead now, and
yeah.
There's no way I can interview him.
Yeah.
Do you know how long he had been at Vung Tao? In charge of... He was actually the head of RD, right?
Well, he was in charge of training. at the National Training Center.
Okay.
But then he would have had, yeah. He would have had a boss.
Actually, the guys who were head of the RD program up in Saigon didn't carry the weight that the regional officers did in the regions. These are the guys that really carry the weight.
Now, is Donahue in Saigon at this time?
Donahue, no. Donahue had left and gone back to Washington by 65 or something like that. Okay. He was there in 64, 65. He was there when they picked up all the pieces of what was left after Strategic Hamlet and started a new program.
Okay.
And this was the beginning of this.
So Revolutionary Development is what takes over from Strategic Hamlet, in effect?
If you want to get into the history, Donahue will be better than anyone. Tanak Chow, who's now, I understand, out on the West Coast somewhere.
Yeah.
Tanak Chow, if you've read about
him. Yes, Scott told me all about him.
Okay. Now, he's one of the early guys who was involved in this.
Yeah.
Before Colonel Bay, even, I think.
Yeah.
And then Bay got into it later. But Donahue was involved in all of that. Now, maybe Scott would have all that background, too.
Well, there's no way. He's back in Turkey. There's no way.
He's there for 5 years. Tom Donahue, you can get. I can give you Donahue's number if you want.
Yeah, that'd be great. Okay.
You know? Now, Van had worked on the operational level. Sterling Cottrell was a coordinator, so he didn't know how to implement the programs,
mm-hmm.
but he was very good at getting people to work together and that sort of thing.
Cottrell was Van's boss?
No. They're in different regions.
Okay.
See, at that time, Van was up in three corps.
Okay.
All right? And Cottrell was down in four corps.
Okay.
And Cottrell was replaced by Wilbur Wilson, and Wilson was replaced by John Paul Van.
Right, okay. Colby told me that he felt that the most significant move he made in Vietnam
was putting
Van in the
Delta. Yeah.
That's what he said to me.
Yeah. Well,
then Wilson goes to 3 Corps, and they switch places, Van and Wilson.
Yeah.
Okay.
But one of the reasons, I think, why Van wanted to go to the Delta was due to some... Wilbur Wilson and I got together, and we had deplored from the very beginning. One of the failures in the Revolutionary Development Program was the fact that General Westmoreland had early in... beginning of 67 or early in that maybe even, had said that he wanted to relegate 50-some-odd Arvin battalions to pacification duties.
Yeah.
Okay? These Arvin battalions were never trained or told what to do. All they were supposed to do was protect the pacified areas.
Mm-hmm.
A few didn't do a bad job. Most of them were worthless. Most of them would they stayed in battalion formations practically. They didn't decentralize and break up into companies and platoons as they should have.
Mm-hmm.
They had static defenses. They would send patrols off, and they would establish patterns of patrolling that the enemy could observe and then evade.
Okay. And this is all because of the Vietnamese generals' thinking.
Yeah, these guys are a bunch of ex-sergeants who had been in the French, sergeants and moved on up, became generals, and they never were properly trained. Now, some of them were good instinctively, but a lot of them were not.
Well, where are their American advisors?
Well, a lot of their American advisors were also conventional warriors.
Okay, alright.
And they didn't understand the Revolutionary Development Program, and they didn't like the idea of being on pacification duties, and they wanted to get involved in maneuver operations.
I understand. Okay.
So they were all pissed off.
Okay, so you and Wilson didn't like that.
We didn't like this at all, and we said that the only way in which we're going to solve this problem of providing security for the pacified areas is through using units that we ourselves can exert some control over, or the province chiefs can exert some control over. We can persuade the province chiefs. Now, that meant more RF and PF. So Wilson began pushing real hard through cords for more RF and PF everywhere. And at the same time, General Abrams had instituted a program for training RF and PF.
Okay. And Abrams is Westy's deputy at that time?
At that time, yeah.
Okay.
That was the first assignment Abrams was given, was to upgrade RF and PF for territorial security.
Yep.
You see? Now, Wilson increased the number of RF and PF forces by about 50% in the Delta. That was a tremendous increase.
Yeah, and this is because it has Comer and Colby's backing all the way.
Right.
Yeah, because I know Colby said RF PF was the key to the thing.
I was pushing it all the time.
Okay.
So it wasn't just, no, he'd be going through one channel, I'd be going through other channels and so forth,
okay.
And we'd be talking to everybody we possibly could have about it.
And, okay. And this is actually putting guns in the hands of Vietnamese.
Well, putting guns in the hands of Vietnamese in the RF and in the PF and then also in the PSDF.
Yep.
People's Self-Defense Forces.
Okay.
Okay. Now, this is what enabled them under the Accelerated Pacification Program in the latter part of 1968 to really make tremendous progress.
Okay. And now, is this, are the RFPF and the PSDF, they come under the MIL groups, the American Military Advisor groups are advising them?
Yeah. See, the American Military Advisory Group was, they operated two ways. One was they're assigned to conventional military units.
Okay.
Okay. Now, those guys were not under the CORDS concept.
Right.
Under CORDS came the province senior advisors and all of the people who were advising at the district level or at the province level.
Okay.
Okay? So, they, all those people, came under Comer or Colby.
Yep.
Who were the deputies to the commanding general.
First Comer, then Colby.
Yeah. First Comer, then Colby. Okay? And so that eventually, these guys all had, Comer and Colby had more guys under them with guns, by far, than General Palmer did.
Yeah.
Hey.
I talked with Palmer for a bit.
Did you?
Yeah. Because I know, I also talked to the guy who worked for Palmer, and Palmer, this guy said that Palmer sent him, and he was a regular military intelligence guy, special security, had been sent to the Delta to set up ISECs, or one of the ISECs things in early 68.
Oh.
Did you ever hear that?
What was his name?
Fulcher. Stan Fulcher.
Stan Fulcher. He was probably sent to one of the provinces then.
Yeah, he was sent to, Sadek or Vinh Long to set up in that province, the ISECs intelligence.
Probably, if it was ISECs, then it was early.
Yeah, 68, early 68.
Well, by that time it already became Phoenix, I think.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. This is getting the RF and the PF to be increased in large numbers, getting PSDF, getting the PRU program really working, getting the ERD program really working. These are all the things that made the main contributions to the Delta. Now, we then just ask that the 21st Division, the 7th Division, 9th Division, that they be targeted against main force units.
Yeah.
And concentrate on main force units. And the hell with providing territorial security, because they couldn't do it. They didn't know how to do it.
Yeah. They that's strictly American outfits, the 27th.
No. 21st Arvin Division.
Okay.
The 7th Arvin Division.
Okay.
And there was a 9th U.S. division that had two brigades.
Yeah, the 9th is the U.S. Okay, but the other two are Arvin.
Arvin, right.
Yeah, okay. I know that
there was also a 9th Arvin division, too.
Okay. All right, so that, in the course of your year there from summer of 60, from late 67 through...
Well, it was more than a year there because I was there from August of 67 in the Delta.
Yeah.
This is running things. Until December of 68.
Okay. And in the course of that time, what we've just talked about in terms of RD is the changes that were made and the program you instituted. And you took it from...
These are the things we're pushing, right from...
Okay. Where did that RD... What province was that in? The Aussies there with Colonel Bernard and his
team? The Aussies were mostly down in the Baswan area.
How do you spell that?
And
then did they take it on the, put it on the road and take it to all the different provinces?
They started in one Phong Thien area. Let's see if I can show you here.
Okay.
And had them in the Delta, had them
but go around in the provinces, the different provinces in the Delta.
Yeah.
Okay.
Here.
Yes.
Hey, start in Feng Zhen Province here, okay? That's right here. 28. Okay. Yeah. Okay. And then they moved in at Baswen, which is number three here.
Uh-huh.
Baswen, which is right next to it. And this, of course, is the Irrawaddy, runs through here, the Basak and the Irrawaddy.
Okay.
Right through there.
All right, so from, why did it start there? Was there a particular reason?
Well, just because we decided, I guess one of the reasons for it is because my senior province officer in Feng Zhen Province.
Yeah.
Was Leroy Suddeth. He was a West Point Lieutenant Colonel. Okay? And I...
How do you spell that last name?
Suddeth, S-U-D-D-A-T-H.
Okay.
Okay? Now, I brought him up to become my chief of paramilitary operations.
Okay.
Okay? He is now Major General Suddeth, commander of the 1st Special Operations Command. Special Forces Command, rather.
Ah.
He commands all the Green Berets.
1st SOCOM.
Yeah, 1st SOCOM.
Yeah, okay. All my Green Beret friends talk about that all the time. Yeah.
Okay, now, okay. He's commander of 1st SOCOM, and I hope he's going to become the Lieutenant General in command of all Special Forces Operations.
Well, okay, maybe after you give me Donnie's, you can give me his, if you stay in touch with him, too.
Yeah, I still see him, yeah, sure.
Okay.
That's why I was up there giving a two-hour lecture on terrorism up there a couple of months ago. Because he said he wanted me to get up there and talk.
All right, so he was the province senior advisor in Feng Zhen at that time. And you knew that you could work well with him and that...
We could sit down and talk about this problem together, and then he would go ahead and... He's the guy to push the rest of the program, then. I sort of delegated it to him, as I recall.
He stopped being the province senior advisor, and he became chief of paramilitary operations, and in that role then went around to the different provinces and made sure that this new RD program got started throughout the Delta. Is that what happened?
Under my supervision, we got the Aussies in, okay? We get them started.
So he was like the liaison.
He was probably
the guy to Bernard.
He's probably the one that moved them. No, Bernard. We never saw Bernard again. He sent those two guys down. We never saw him again.
So he worked right with those two warrant officers.
What he did was then, when the guys would come in and they say, okay, we finished in this area, but we'd like to get some more experience at some other types of terrain.
Uh huh.
And so he sent them down to Baswen.
Okay.
Okay. And Baswen is right next to Feng Zhen there.
Yeah.
See?
Okay.
And I remember seeing them a couple of times in Baswen when I went out to visit some of the RD teams out in the field and see how they were doing.
Okay. And now...
I check with these guys.
Yeah, everything we're talking about now from this point is just the Delta.
And it's all the Delta.
Yeah, there's a complete... Is there a different RD program in 3, 2, 1?
Now, once the program... Once Colonel Bay got hold of the training concept, then he instituted nationally, yeah.
Okay.
Now, I don't know the extent to which this worked on a national basis, because everything was moving so fast then. Then they began the breakdown of the RD teams. And then...
From 59 down to 30.
Right.
That breakdown.
And then, right after that, when I went back to Washington, one of the first things I had to do was to turn over the entire program to the military.
Okay.
And the U.S. military took it over. Remember, I was dealing with a Colonel Bond at the time, back in Washington. He later was killed. He became General Bond and was killed in Vietnam.
Huh. So actually, the military then, MACV, takes over RD in 69. 70.
In 69, I guess it was, they took it over. 69.
Okay, and at that point, anybody who had been working for CIA stopped working for CIA and went and started working for the military?
No. Everything was just turned over, and the military assigned their own personnel to take over the RD program.
Okay. And it'd be like at that point that somebody like Savaggio then would go work someplace else.
Well, I think Savaggio, he was with ECA, you see.
What's that?
ECA. Economic Development Administration.
Oh, okay.
AID is now. I keep using terms from over the years. I say MSA or ECA, depending on what the devil was calling it.
He was with
the
Agency for International Development.
Right, AID,
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was one time called ECA, Economic Cooperation Administration. Another time was MSA, was it Mutual Support?
There were different names
over the years. That,
Okay, that's very interesting. So MAC, and once MACV takes over RD, then it becomes military advisors,
well,
strictly military.
But also at the same time, you see, as the area is being pacified,
mm-hmm.
the RD teams were also sort of being upgraded as far as their specialties were concerned.
Okay.
And they no longer really had basic security missions. Their jobs then were tying into the ministries.
Yeah.
If somebody was in the field of education, you know, building schoolhouses,
yeah.
manning them and so forth, then he would tie in with the education ministry. If they were involved in health, they'd tie in with the Ministry of Health.
Okay.
See, if they're involved in setting up a clinic or something like that. So that the RD teams then
mm-hmm.
began to be phased out by being tied directly into the ministries.
Okay. What about...
this is all going along with Vietnamization.
Right, yeah. Okay. What about PRU operations in the Delta?
Now, PRU and the Delta were probably the finest fighting force in the country.
Okay.
Okay. Now, each guy in the PRU originally started off as a counter-terrorist program.
Yep, well aware of that.
Okay. And that was not too well received in certain circles, so that was not the basic mission, actually. They were trying to counter-terror. They were trying to get at some of the guys that were, you know,
yeah.
ordering the assassination of school teachers and village headmen
yeah,
and policemen.
Yeah, do unto them as they did unto
right.
them. Right, okay.
But that was not their basic mission. Their basic mission, they were an armed intelligence collection unit.
Mm-hmm.
Their basic mission was to capture prisoners and bring back documents. And frequently, a lot of American commanding generals wanted to use them to go in after B-52 strikes to see what the situation was.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they were used to go into VC territory and put posters up on the trees
yep.
stating 10,000 piastre reward offered for information leading to the apprehension and conviction of so-and-so who's wanted for
yeah,
murder.
Yeah, win-win. Yep.
You know,
yep.
that sort of thing. But we had Navy SEALs
okay.
and some special forces personnel advising them in the Delta.
Okay. How big of an American advisory force was there to the PRU in the Delta?
In the Delta? Well, the PRU came basically under the RD guy.
Okay.
And then under him came the SEALs.
Would that have been the RD guy? Would that have been this?
The paramilitary specialist from the, rather than the police
Sudden?
Military specialist.
Not Sudden.
Well, yeah, that would be all under Sudden. Sudden was at the regional level, you see.
Okay.
And Sutter was one of many, many military personnel, a lot of Green Berets and colonels and lieutenant colonels, majors, and but mostly majors and captains,
mm-hmm.
And lieutenant colonels who came with us, signed by the Pentagon to help in the implementation of the RD program
mm-hmm.
and other activities that were being undertaken up there in the
okay.
under Cords.
Okay, so then he would... And he would just be regional for the
He was
the
regional,
Delta.
Yeah.
Okay.
He was over all the 16 areas, I mean...
Yeah, and so he would have either a SEAL or a Special Forces guy in a province running a PRU program.
Well, and he would have, out in the Delta, that'd be... You know, there's one guy who's in police liaison, and then there's another guy who's in RD. Yeah. The guy who's in RD usually had the PRU under him. Although they cooperated so closely together, the two are almost interchangeable, the RD and the police
okay.
liaison sometimes.
And so Suddeth would have a police liaison and an RD guy, both?
Well, no, he didn't have the police liaison. That was strictly intelligence.
Okay.
Okay?
That's special branch.
Yeah.
Okay.
Dealing with special branch.
Okay.
The RD guy was handling the PRU
yeah.
program, the RD program.
Okay.
And other programs such as the census grievance program.
Yeah, I want to talk about that after PRU. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Now the PRU, so basically armed intelligence collection units, okay? And I think I got some mention of that in this paper on the Phoenix program here.
Okay. Did you yourself ever go out with the PRU?
On operations?
Yeah.
Yeah, I went out, but nothing really significant.
Just to see
how they were operating and that sort of stuff. And that was in the early days. That was the beginning when I first went out there. After a while, I was so damn busy, I had no time to go on single operations. Furthermore, it wouldn't have been very wise anyway. You know, when you're responsible
yeah.
for 16 different provinces and thousands of people on the payroll and so forth,
yep.
you don't have time to go up in operations.
Okay.
Then you're playing cowboy, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So you left that to your SEALs and your
right. They're the people that went on these operations.
Okay.
Yeah.
If you remember one of them, if you knew one of them, I'd like to talk to one of them at some point. If you,
you
might remember,
well,
either a SEAL.
You know, you might talk with. He's now a captain in the Navy. Chuck Lemoyne.
Okay.
Charles Irv C. Lemoyne, I think his name is. IRVE. His brother is with the New York Times. Jim Lemoyne. You might read some of his stuff. He's a specialist in Latin America at the moment.
Okay.
He used to be president of the senior class at Harvard while we were in together in the Delta with Chuck. And he's head of the SEAL team.
Okay.
Chuck Lemoyne was.
Is that L-E-M-O-I-N-E?
L-E-M-O-Y-N-E.
Y-N-E.
Let's see if I get his address here.
Okay. A lot of people, when they think about Phoenix, if they even know what Phoenix or Prue was, confuse Phoenix with Prue. That's been the thing that I discovered most in doing a book about Phoenix, is that most people equate Phoenix with Prue, not knowing that Prue had been going on for 10 years
before
Phoenix.
And
I even talked with Tom Polgar yesterday.
Oh, did you?
And he said that they were training the equivalent of Prue's in Cambridge University in 1943 for work in behind enemy lines in Germany. You know, that it was
it's a concept.
Yeah, it's just as a concept, and it's nothing new.
But what I find as an example of how that works, though, the crew are basically were specially selected, everyone, and everyone was given individual training at the crew center at Vung Tau, crew training center there. Okay, so they were trained as individuals in collecting intelligence.
Okay, but
they didn't necessarily run agents, not that kind of intelligence.
Yeah, right.
Their job was reconnaissance, and they were good at that. Capturing prisoners, capturing documents. They would go through, and some of the Americans, like with the 9th Division, always wanted to have them go along with them, and 101st and 1st Aid Cav and others always used to talk about the crew, how they could go through documents so quickly. They knew exactly what to look for, what was worthwhile and what wasn't, because they'd gotten so many of them.
This is part of their training, but it's also
part
based
of their training,
on their experience.
Their experience, mostly. And, you know, training never stops.
Yeah.
If you stop training, you're crazy. Training is a continuing process that goes on all the time. Anybody's in the military. After every action, you should have an after-action report. Now, this is most important. And in your after-action report, you not only write up what happened, what the mission of the operation was, and what happened on the mission, and so forth, but you also write up what went wrong, what went right, and what do you... should you do to upgrade training? I mean, if these guys were pretty noisy on the trail or something of the sort, you know, Prue weren't guilty of that because they'd been that long ago. But if there was something in which they were weak, they needed upgrading in marksmanship for distance work because they'd been mostly in short distance night operations. And here they're fighting across paddy fields and they're not getting the target. Okay, well, they get upgraded in that.
So you're talking that anybody who was in a crew unit would periodically get sent back to Vung Tau for more training?
No,
so
they'd be trained mostly right there in the province.
Oh, okay.
You kept upgrading them all the time. If certain guys need training in marksmanship, they'd get it in marksmanship. If other guys needed training in other activities, they'd be given training in that.
Okay. By their SEAL or Special Forces advisors.
Right.
Okay.
And
who would probably also
be... frequently by their own bosses, you know,
the Vietnamese
crew.
Okay.
Now, the way the crew were picked, they were frequently, you know, you'd hear there were thugs, there were ex-VC.
Convicts, chuhois, everything.
Yeah, a lot of them were ex-VC.
Yeah.
Maybe between 20% and 33rd, maybe, okay? A lot of them in the Delta were Cambodians.
Okay.
Cambodian ethnics.
Yeah.
Particularly near the border there.
Another 33%?
No, not that many. I'm not quite sure, but it'd be 15. Some provinces wouldn't have any.
Okay.
And some provinces would be 15 to 20% or more.
I understand that one or two of the provinces in the Delta were mostly Cambodians.
Yeah, some of them were.
Yeah.
Probably, yeah.
Okay.
Maybe in Chau Duc, for example, I'm sure there'd be a high incidence of Cambodians there. Maybe in Kien Phong province, too.
Okay.
Okay. Now, a lot of them were classified as deserters. And here's what happened. A guy would join the army, and frequently he would find that his army unit has been reorganized, he's been sent for training, and then he's assigned to Quang Tri province. And yet his family is down the Delta, and he wants to be near his wife. So he goes on vacation, he deserts. And the first thing he does is go to the province chief. And he say, you know, I'm a first-class radio operator. Or I'm a good marksman, or I'm this or that, and so forth. Can you use me down here in the province? And frequently the province chiefs would say, well, let's, they'd work out a way if they could use them. And frequently these guys would get into the PRU if they're really good. But the province chief selected all these people, so they're usually only about the best that he could get.
And the Pru were responsible to the province chief.
Right, to the province chief. Directly to the province chief.
Okay,
now, while they were trained and dispatched and run by us for the most part, sometimes the province chiefs, we had problems with province chiefs. Some of these guys wanted to use Pru for their personal bodyguards. And that was a problem. And for example, I remember the province chief in Vin Long. We would devise an operation. They'd send six PRU on an operation deep into enemy territory to pick up a guy. To capture him and bring him back alive. Maybe he's a security chief at a district level or something of the sort. Key guy in the infrastructure. And the operation is brought to the province chief, and instead of him just signing off, he reads the thing and he says, six men, that's deep in enemy territory. And he puts a zero beside the six. He says, send 60 men, you know. Well, if you send 60 men on an operation like that, they're going to have to fight their way in and out. They can't move in by stealth. And so our guy will argue with the province chief and perhaps get nowhere. Then he talks to the province senior advisor, the American. And he talks to the province chief and he gets nowhere. So then they call me. Then I got to go up and sit down and talk with the province chief.
Now
this time we begin to put the squeeze on the guy and explain to him. It's usually some very conventional guy who's been trained in a division almost and never been outside of it. And he believes in plenty of firepower, and he sees the way the Americans have used firepower out there.
Because so, most of the chiefs were often officers.
They're all often officers.
Okay.
So that was, you know, we were constantly having problems with district chiefs and province chiefs. And
people have told me whether or not they were successful or failed in a province depended on the personality of the province chief.
To quite a degree. Now, some province chiefs were very permissive, and they let us do almost anything. Other province chiefs were very sticky. You know, about certain things. So you would, but generally I would tell these guys, look, don't complain to me about your province chief. You handle him if you can. Now, if you find that there's no way you can do it, then call me. But if you, if there's any solution that you can figure out on the province and you call me instead of figuring out the solution yourself, I'm going to hold it against you.
And as the region advisor, you could say that to them.
Did all their fitness reports.
Who was your Vietnamese counterpart?
The guy that I worked with mostly, well, it would be the commanding general.
You
know? But it depended on what you were doing.
I get it. So you wear different hats, so you have a different counterpart for each hat. But overall, it would have been the commanding general of that region. Who was?
Well,
was it Quang?
Now, Quang was there at the very beginning, but Quang went out and General Mann replaced him. General Mann.
What's the spelling on
that? M-A-N-H.
General
Mann was a, supposedly a very good administrator, a good linguist, spoke several languages, fluent French, fluent English, and not quite fluent English, and so forth. But General Mann had the courage of a rabbit. And so we got him pulled out after 10 and replaced by General Nguyen Duc Thanh. Now, Nguyen Duc Thanh was a great officer.
That's T-H-A-N-H.
T-H-A-N-G.
Thanh, okay.
Thanh had been the Minister for Revolutionary Development.
That
one.
Lieutenant
General from the North at the time that I got him down in the Delta. And what he did was transform the Delta and put it on into an offensive posture instead of the defensive posture that General Mann had it right after Tet. He ordered all troops out of the cities. Into the countryside. All troops onto the offensive. Changed everything almost immediately overnight.
Well, I've often heard that Delta was the most successful region in Vietnam. Do you think that that's an assessment that stands up?
He was one of the reasons for it at that particular time. And But he only stayed 3 months.
Yeah.
But he did switch the Delta right around quickly. Actually, right after he got there, he and I and General George Eckert was very good.
Yeah, he was. He became executive officer to Jacobson, I think. In Courts.
And he became deputy to Courts.
Yeah.
Deputy to Colby.
Yeah, right.
The deputy.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good. Hang on.
You mentioned, I think his name was George Eckert?
General George Eckert, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Major General.
And,
I think he was the oldest Major General in the U.S. Army. Well, senior Major General in the U.S. Army at that time.
Okay. And in what regard was did his name, is his name come up?
Let's see, we were talking earlier. Oh, Tet was something special, you know, in,
yeah.
in 68. And I had gone home on leave we're entitled to 3 weeks leave every 6 or 8 or 9 months, something like that. And I went home for a few weeks leave and was caught there when Tet occurred. And of course, the moment Tet occurred, I immediately was ordered by Washington, D.C. to go right straight back out of the field to cut my leave short. And I did. I had difficulty because Pan Am wouldn't fly into Saigon in the, then, and so I had to go to SINCPAC headquarters and get Washington to give me high priority on a military flight going out to Vietnam. So I got back on out there, and I was out there about the fifth day after Tet started, and went down to the Delta and traveled all around trying to see what I could do, but my deputy and all the other guys had done a great job of keeping things
Who
going.
Who was your deputy at that point?
A fellow named Andy Rogers.
Okay. Was he military?
Andy had been military in World War II. He had been a major so forth, but he was a civilian at the time.
Okay.
Yeah. A very good guy. He's now on the West Coast. Anyway, Andy kept things going down there in the Delta and supplied ammunition and so forth as needed all around and kept everything going. But the situation looked almost hopeless because General Mann was on a defensive posture. He was closed the street, main street in Kanto, in front of his house. He had closed it up totally and had barbed wire, barricades, and tanks protecting his house.
Is that where you were? Is that where your headquarters were?
In Kanto, yeah.
Can you tell me whereabouts in Kanto?
I had a house between the town and the airport.
Okay.
Okay, anyway, the situation in the Delta was pretty damn bad. And so we, you know, had to send reports to Saigon, and they sent them to Washington on the situation in the Delta, in which we deplored the defensive posture of all of the Arvin units and indicated that General Mann was totally inadequate for this job, and they needed a general who knew the importance of going on the offensive. And we recommended Winder Tung if we could get him down there, and anyway they did. He was the only one who was available who we knew had the balls to do the job. And he did get sent down there. We did replace General Mann and did a super job.
Starting maybe in February or March or something?
I think he was down there by the 1st of March.
Okay.
And the moment he came, he immediately electrified everything, the mm-hmm. town. His impact was immediate, because the first thing he said was, I'm not going to stay in General Mann's house, I'm going to stay at Four Corps headquarters.
Okay.
I want a cot. And they said, we don't have any quarters here for living at the headquarters. And he said, put a cot in the back of a truck and I'll sleep in that. I want to be right next to, and he said, this is going to be a 24-hour day job, I'll be available at any time. He said, second, I want all that barbed wire and I'll eliminate in front of General Mann's house and open up that main road. Well, of course, every taxi driver and every person who traveled mm-hmm. to the airport or anywhere else immediately saw the main road was open again.
Yeah.
And that had an impact on everything.
Positive effect.
The third thing he said was, I want every single unit out of the city of Kanto. Everybody's going on the offensive.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to stay on the defensive. And I want at least one night operation a week, and I want 4 offensive operations by every single soldier in the outfit. A week. Well, anyway, that you know, when all the troops move out of town, all the barbed wire is pulled up, and the general doesn't even stay in the house there, and he's staying right down at Fort Corps headquarters. You know, that had an immediate impact.
Inspirational.
And he immediately advised every single province officer, province chief, that he had to do the same thing.
Okay.
And that all of the units would go on the offensive. And they wouldn't go for walks in the sun. They were going, supposed to be going in against the enemy, targeted. And so we told them that what we really needed to do was to get these district operations coordinating centers going.
Okay.
And to get the police and the military targeting, getting the intelligence. This was what he thought was one of the great weaknesses out there.
Okay.
And so he and I and General Eckert traveled around the Delta, and we talked to all the province chiefs and the district chiefs and all American advisors.
Was Eckert in charge of the 9th Infantry Division?
He had been earlier, but okay. At this time he was the 4th Corps senior advisor.
Okay.
Okay, so he was the senior advisor to General Winduk Tung at that time.
Okay.
So we went around and we hit, in 3 days we hit every province. We talked to every single province chief and so forth, and we told him we wanted these things implemented immediately.